They tried to break through the barricades on Capitol Street, but the cops forced them back into line. When they reached the funeral home, the body was taken inside and most of the procession dispersed. But one hardcore of angry Negroes decided they didn't want to go home. With some encouragement from SNCC workers who were singing freedom songs outside the funeral home, these people began walking back toward Capitol Street. Policemen had been placed along the route of the march, and they were still there. They allowed the crowd of Negroes to march 7 blocks, but they formed a solid blockade just short of Capitol Street. This was where they made everyone stop. They had everything, shotguns, fire trucks, gas masks, dogs, fire hoses, and billy clubs. Along the sidewalks and on the fringes of the crowd, the cops knocked heads, set dogs on some marchers, and made about 30 arrests, but the main body of people in the middle of the street was just stopped. They sang and shouted things like, "Shoot! Shoot!" to the police, and then the police started to push them back slowly. After being pushed back about a block, they stopped. They wouldn't go any farther, so the cops brought the fire trucks up closer and got ready to use the fire hoses on the crowd. That really broke up the demonstration. People moved back faster and started to go home. But it also made them angrier. Bystanders began throwing stones and bottles at the cops, and then the crowd started too. Other Negroes were pitching stuff from second and third story windows. The crowd drew back another block, leaving the space between them and the fire trucks littered with rocks and broken glass. John Doerr came out from behind the police barricade and walked toward the crowd of Negroes with bottles flying all around him. He talked to some of the people at the front, telling them he was from the Justice Department and that this wasn't the way. After he talked for a few minutes, things calmed down considerably, and Dave Dennis and a few others began taking bottles away from people and telling them they should go home. After that, it was just a cleanup operation. One of the ministers borrowed Captain Ray's bullhorn and ran up and down the street telling people to disperse, but by that time, there were just a few stragglers. After Medgar's death, there was a period of confusion. Each Negro leader and organization in Jackson received threats. They were all told they were next on the list. Things began to fall apart. The ministers, in particular, didn't want to be next. A number of them took that long promised vacation to Africa or elsewhere. Meanwhile, SNCC and CORE became more militant and began to press for more demonstrations. A lot of the young Negroes wanted to let the whites of Jackson know that even by killing off Medgar, they hadn't touched the real core of the movement. For the NAACP and the older, more conservative groups, however, voter registration had now become number one on the agenda. After the NAACP exerted its influence at a number of strategy meetings, the militants lost. The Jackson Daily News seized the opportunity to cause more fragmentation. One day, they ran a headline, "There is a split in the organizations." And sure enough, shortly afterward, certain organizations had completely severed their relations with each other. The whites had succeeded again. They had reached us through the papers by letting us know we were not together. Too bad, I thought. One day we'll learn. It's pretty tough, though, when you have everything against you, including the money, the newspapers, and the cops. Within a week, everything had changed. Even the rallies were not the same. The few ministers and leaders who did come were so scared, they thought assassins were going to follow them home. Soon, there were rallies only twice a week instead of every night. The Sunday following Medgar's funeral, Reverend Ed King organized an integrated church visiting team of 6 of us from the college. Another team was organized by a group in Jackson. Five or six churches were hit that day, including Governor Ross Barnett's. At each one, they had prepared for our visit with armed policemen, paddy wagons, and dogs, which would be used in case we refused to leave after ushers had read us the prepared resolutions. There were about eight of these ushers at each church, and they were never exactly the usherly type. They were more on the order of Al Capone. I think this must have been the first time any of these men had worn a flower in his lapel. When we were asked to leave, we did. We were never even allowed to get past the first step. A group of us decided that we would go to church again the next Sunday. This time, we were quite successful. These visits had not been publicized as the first ones were, and they were not really expecting us. We went first to a Church of Christ, where we were greeted by the regular ushers. After reading us the same resolution we had heard last week, they offered to give us cab fare to the Negro extension of the church. Just as we had refused and were walking away, an old lady stopped us. "We'll sit with you," she said. We walked back to the ushers with her and her family. "Please, let them in, Mr. Calloway. We'll sit with them," the old lady said. "Mrs. Dixon, the church has decided what is to be done. A resolution has been passed, and we are to abide by it." "Who are we to decide such a thing? This is a house of God, and God is to make all of the decisions. He is the judge of us all," the lady said. The ushers got angrier then and threatened to call the police if we didn't leave. We decided to go. "We appreciate very much what you've done," I said to the old lady. As we walked away from the church, we noticed the family leaving by a side entrance. The old lady was waving to us. Two blocks from the church, we were picked up by Ed King's wife, Jeanette. She drove us to an Episcopal church. She had previously left the other two girls from our team there. She circled the block a couple of times, but we didn't see them anywhere. I suggested that we try the church. "Maybe they got in," I said. Mrs. King waited in the car for us. We walked up to the front of the church. There were no ushers to be seen. Apparently, services had already started. When we walked inside, we were greeted by two ushers who stood at the rear. "May we help you?" one said. "Yes," I said. "We would like to worship with you today. Will you sign the guest list, please, and we will show you to your seats," said the other. I stood there for a good 5 minutes before I was able to compose myself. I had never prayed with white people in a white church before. We signed the guest list and were then escorted to two seats behind the other two girls in our team. We had all gotten in. The church service was completed without one incident. It was as normal as any church service. However, it was by no means normal to me. I was sitting there, thinking any moment God would strike the life out of me. I recognized some of the whites sitting around me in that church. If they were praying to the same God I was, then even God, I thought, was against me. When the services were over, the minister invited us to visit again. He said it as if he meant it, and I began to have a little hope. Chapter 23. In July, CORE opened up an office in Canton, Mississippi, to start a voter registration campaign in Madison County. By this time, I was so fed up with the fighting and bickering among the organizations in Jackson, I was ready to go almost anywhere, even Madison County, where Negroes frequently turned up dead. Shortly before Christmas, a man's headless corpse had been found on the road between Canton and Tougaloo, with the genitals cut off and with K's cut into the flesh all over his body. Around the time the body was found, Tougaloo College had received a lot of threats, so an inventory was made of all the males on campus to see if any were missing. When Reverend King discovered that I had agreed to work with CORE in the area, he was very much concerned. He discussed Canton with me, telling me he thought the place was too rough for girls. Some of my girlfriends also begged me not to go, but I just had to. I don't know why I felt that way, but I did. Because I had come from Wilkinson County, I just didn't think Madison could be any worse. Things might even be a little better, I thought, since in Madison there were 3 Negroes to every white. I remembered that in Jackson there had been one point when I could see the white folks actually tremble with fear. At times when we were having mass demonstrations, we had them so confused they didn't know what to do. Whenever I could detect the least amount of fear in any white Mississippian, I felt good. I also felt there was a chance of winning the battle, regardless of how costly it turned out to be. Disregarding all facts of violence, Madison County was considered a place with a possible future for Negroes. In addition to the fact that our record showed that there was a population of 29,000 Negroes as against 9,000 whites, Negroes owned over 40% of the land in the county. However, there were only about 150 to 200 registered to vote, and these had registered as a result of a campaign conducted by a few local citizens a couple of years earlier. Of this number, less than half were actually voting. I arrived in Canton with Dave Dennis one Friday evening and was taken straight to the CORE office, a small room adjoining a Negro cafe. The cafe was owned by C.O. Chin and his wife, a well-established Negro family. It was located on Franklin Street in the center of one of Canton's Negro sections. Dave and I were just in time to have supper there with George Raymond, the project director, and Betty Poole, my old Tougaloo buddy. Dave introduced me to Mrs. Chin. She was a stout lady with a warm and friendly smile. I liked her right away. I spent the entire evening sitting around the office talking to her and George Raymond about Madison County. The office had been open only a few weeks, and in that time, Mrs. Chin had already had her liquor license taken away. The place had been broken into twice, and many Negroes had been physically threatened. George reported that, so far, mostly teenagers were involved in the movement. He said that about 50 dedicated teenage canvassers showed up each day. They were sent out daily, but had little success. Most of the Negroes just didn't want to be bothered, Mrs. Chin told me. That's the way it is all over, I thought. Most Negroes have been thoroughly brainwashed. If they aren't brainwashed, they are too insecure. Either they work for Miss Anne or they live on Mr. Charlie's place. I just didn't see how the Negroes in Madison County could be so badly off. They should have had everything going for them, outnumbering the whites 3-1 and owning just about as much land as they did. When I discussed this point with Mrs. Chin, I discovered that, although they did own the land, they were allowed to farm only so much of it. Cotton is the main crop in Mississippi, and as Mrs. Chin explained that night, the federal government controls cotton by giving each state a certain allotment. Each state decides how much each county gets, and each county distributes the allotments to the farmers. It always ends up with the white people getting most of the allotments, Mrs. Chin said. The Negroes aren't able to get more, regardless of how much land they have. Most of the farmers in Madison County were barely living off what they made from their land. Besides, they were never clear from debt. The independent farmers were practically like sharecroppers because they always had their crop planted. pledged in advance. The more I thought about it, the more it seemed that the federal government was directly or indirectly responsible for most of the segregation, discrimination, and poverty in the South. Later, I was taken to the Freedom House, which had been provided by Mrs. Chin's brother, Sonny. The house was newly built and very nice. There were 3 bedrooms, a living room, dining room, and kitchen. Sonny was a young man who had recently separated from his wife. Since his brother Robert lived with him now, we kind of crowded them, forcing them to share a bed, but they didn't seem to mind. The more I saw of the Chins, the more I began to like and respect them. They were the one Negro family in Canton who had put their necks on the chopping block. If a couple of other families made similar commitments, I thought, we might just get this place moving. There was a rally that night at the Corps office. Mrs. Chin was the only adult there among about 20 teenagers. We sang freedom songs for about 2 hours. After that, George gave a brief talk and introduced me, saying, I want you people to meet one of my co-workers. She is going to spend some time with us here in and around Madison County. She is a real soul sister. Why don't you stand, Anne? As I rose, one of the boys in the back gave a wolf whistle. I don't mean that kind of soul sister, Esco, George said. What I mean is, she is dedicated, man. She has been beaten and kicked all over Jackson. Remember that bloody sit-in and the other demonstrations? She was in all of them. She has been in jail 4 or 5 times, and as a result, she can't even go home again. She is all right, and don't you guys go getting any notions. Anne, won't you say a few words? I felt I had to say something real serious after those remarks. Anyway, I thought, I better take advantage of such an introduction to put those teenage boys in their place from the get-go. If not, I might have a little trouble on my hands later. Therefore, I decided to pull the religious bit. Now that I was facing the street, I saw that outside the cops were on the ball. There they were, 2 carloads of them. They were taking it all in. The watchdogs of the Klan. They wouldn't miss a meeting for anything. I was beginning to hate them with a passion. I just might try and give them something to think about, too, I thought. It seems as though a few of us have the spirit tonight, I started. Yes, we got it all right, one of the boys said, somewhat freshly. A few is not enough, I continued. If a change is going to take place in Canton, as we just said in one of the songs, then it's going to take more than a few believers. Where are the rest of the adults besides Mrs. Chin? Where are your parents, sisters and brothers, and your other friends? We sit back and say that we want freedom. We believe that all men are created equal. Some of us even believe we are free just because our Constitution guarantees us certain inalienable rights. There are the 13th, 14th, and 15th Amendments that make us citizens and give us the right to vote. If you are depending on the writing on the wall to free you, you better forget it. It's been there a long time. We've got to be the ones to give it meaning. Some of us believe that once we get enough nerve, all we gotta do is walk up to Mr. Charlie and say, Man, I want my freedom. Do you think that Mr. Charlie is going to dish it out to you on a silver platter? No, he'll tell me that I'm already free, one of the boys said. If he is that bold and thinks you are that crazy, then you should be bold and crazy enough to ask him a few more questions, I said. Questions like what? He said. Like, what am I free to do? I said. Then name a few things you can't do if he continues. In fact, if you ever get enough nerve to do it, let me know what happens. I probably won't live to tell you about it, the boy said. So you see, it's not that simple, and all of you know that, I said. Now that we know that we are not free and realize what's involved in freeing ourselves, we have to take certain positive actions to work on the problem. First of all, we have got to get together. I was told that it's 29,000 Negroes in this county to 9,000 whites. What's wrong with you? Don't you realize what you have going for you? When I said this, those overseers outside began to pace nervously. I had touched a nerve in them, and I felt good, but I decided to stop before I overdid it. I ended by saying, I am looking forward to the work ahead of me. I will certainly do my best to help you get the message across to Mr. Charlie. Then I took a seat. George got up and said, See, I told you she was all right. Now let's sing a few more songs. Then go home and see what we can come up with to start on Mr. Charlie. All right, soul brothers and sisters. All right, Mrs. Chin said. We are going to get that freedom yet, ain't we? A few shouts of amen and show enough came from the teenagers. We sang three songs, ending with We Shall Overcome, and everyone went home. All that night I kept thinking about that pitiful meeting. We just had to get some more adults involved, somehow. The next day, Saturday, I went to the office to check over some of the reports by previous canvassing teams. I had been working for a few hours when George came in. Come outside. I want to show you something, he said. I ran into the street thinking someone was being beaten by the cops or there was some other kind of Saturday night happening out there. Take a good look at that, George said. Just about every Negro in Madison County for miles around. It wasn't hard for me to believe what I was seeing. I had seen it too many times before. In Centerville, my hometown, the same thing took place. Saturday night was known as Nigger Night. That's how the whites put it. Come on, George said. Let's walk out on Pear Street, the main street in Canton. As we walked there, we had to push our way through crowds of Negroes. On Pear Street itself, everything was at a standstill. There were so many Negroes, and they were packed so closely together they could barely move. Look over there, I said to George. Where? He asked. At the two white cops standing on that corner, I said. They look pretty lonely and stupid, huh? They sure do, I said. Look just like they are in a completely black town at this moment. Most whites don't even bother to come in on Saturdays, I've noticed, George said. I stood there looking and thinking. Yes, Saturday night is Nigger Night all over Mississippi. I remembered in Centerville, when it was too cold for anyone to walk the streets, Negroes would come to town and sit in each other's cars and talk. Those that didn't believe in sitting around or hanging out in bars, like my mother, just sat or moved from car to car for 4 or 5 hours. Teenagers who were not allowed in cafes went to a movie and watched the picture 3 or 4 times while they smooched. There was a special lovers section in the movie house on Saturday nights. Often you saw more stirring and arousing scenes in the lovers section than on the screen. Some Negroes would come to town on Saturday night just to pick a fight with another Negro. Once the fight was over, they were satisfied. They beat their frustrations and discontent out on each other. I had often thought that if some of that Saturday night energy was used constructively or even directed at the right objects, it would make a tremendous difference in the life of Negroes in Mississippi. The next week or so, things went along fairly well. Within a few days, I had gotten to know most of the canvassers. They were more energetic than any bunch of teenagers I had known or worked with before. There were about 40 or 50 that reported daily. We kept running into problems. I found it necessary to keep dividing them into smaller teams. First, I divided them into two teams, one for the mornings and one for the afternoons. Most of the eligible voters worked during the day, so a third team was organized for the evenings. Some of the teenagers were so energetic that they often went out with all the teams. I usually canvassed with the last team for a couple of hours, then rushed to the Freedom House to cook. It didn't take me long to find out that the Negroes in Madison County were the same as those in most of the other counties. They were just as apathetic or indifferent about voting. Nevertheless, we had begun to get a few more adults out to rallies at night. Pretty soon, the whites saw fit to move in. They wanted to make sure that more adults would not get involved. Since our recruitment and canvassing was done mostly by the teenagers, they decided to scare the teenagers away. One night after a rally, George, Betty, and I had just walked back to the Freedom House when C.O. Chin came rushing in after us. He kept repeating over and over again, "Five kids were just shot! Five kids were just shot!" We stood there motionless, not wanting to believe what we had just heard, afraid to ask any questions. Were they seriously hurt? Was anyone dead? Before any of us said a word, Mr. Chin was saying, "They are at the hospital now, George. Let's go over and see how they are." George got his cap and headed for the door, with Betty and me right behind him. As we were all getting into Mr. Chin's car, Mr. Chin said, "I'm going to leave you girls by my house with Minnie Lou. And you and Betty can't go to the hospital. How do you know they weren't trying to kill one of you? Maybe one of the girls was taken for you or Betty." As we approached his house, we saw Mrs. Chin standing in the doorway as if she was about to leave. "Where do you think you're going, Minnie Lou? You're going to stay right here with Ann and Betty," Mr. Chin said. Mrs. Chin didn't answer. The voice of authority had spoken. Mrs. Chin, Betty, and I simply did as we were told. We sat around the house talking until about 4 a.m., and then we all tried to get some sleep. I didn't sleep at all. I kept thinking of what might possibly happen. This was probably just a warning. Something else was coming on. I could feel it. Finally, it was daylight, and Mr. Chin and George still hadn't returned. Maybe they didn't want to face us and say so-and-so died. "Ann? Ann!" Mrs. Chin was calling me. "Are you asleep?" "No," I answered. "Let's go down to the office. Maybe C.O. and George are there," she said. We all got up and headed for the office. We arrived just as Mr. Chin and George were getting out of the car. "They're okay," Mr. Chin told us. "They were released from the hospital about 5:30 this morning." He explained that they had been hit with buckshot. That afternoon, when the five teenagers came to the office to fill out affidavits to be sent to the Justice Department, I heard the full story. They had been walking home down Pear Street after last night's rally when the incident occurred. As they passed the service station on the opposite side of the street, Price Lewis, the white owner, had been standing in the doorway. This did not seem unusual. They generally saw him there. Then, just as they were crossing the railroad tracks to the left of the service station, they heard a loud noise. They looked back and noticed that Price Lewis was now holding a shotgun pointed in their direction. At this point, one of the girls said she looked down and discovered blood was running down her legs into her shoes. She realized she had been shot and saw that the others had been wounded by buckshot pellets, too. Price Lewis had been arrested at the service station and taken to jail during the morning. Immediately, he posted a small bail and was released. Within an hour or so, he was back to work at the service station, carrying on as though nothing had happened. His Negro service attendant was still there, too. He acted as if he really hated being there, and he must have known how other Negroes were looking at him. But I knew he couldn't afford to leave his job. The shooting really messed up our relationship with the teenagers. Within 2 or 3 days, they had stopped coming to the office. I knew that their parents were responsible for most of them not coming back. From the beginning, most of the parents had not approved of their participation in the voter registration drive. Several kids had told me that they came against their parents' wishes, but they also refused to let me go home with them to talk things over with the adults. They took too much pride in the work they were doing with us to let me do that. I think they knew as well as I that it was for themselves and themselves alone that they were working, because within a few years they would be the ones who would have to deal with the whites. Now, however, I felt I had an obligation to go and see their parents. I did so with very little success. Some flatly refused to see me. Those that did gave made-up excuses as to why their children had to stay home. One sent her little boy to the door to tell me she was not home. "Mama say she ain't here," he said. I hardly knew what to do. I was not prepared to cope with this situation. I kept trying to think of some way to get the teenagers involved again. For one thing, we would not be able to get our work done without them. Betty and I tried canvassing alone for a day or so and ended up almost dead from exhaustion. During this lapse in the project, I got one of those weeping letters from Mama again. As usual, she was begging me to leave Mississippi, and as usual, she peeved the hell out of me. But I couldn't take lightly what she said about Wilkinson County. I knew too well what I was up against. The next day, in an attempt to forget her letter, I decided to busy myself with cleaning the office. I got the one teenager that still hung around to help me and sent him to the cafe for a pail of water. When he came back, he said, "Ann, there are 2 white men outside in a car asking to see the person in charge of the office." "Are they from Canton or around here?" I asked. "No," he said. "I've never seen them before." My heart almost jumped right out of me. It was not until then that I really began to think of some of the things in Mama's letter. She had said that the white folks in Centerville had found out that I was in Canton, and that some Negro had told her he heard they planned to bump me off. She had been pleading with me this time as she had never done before. Why did I want to get myself killed? She kept asking. What was I trying to prove? Over and over again, she said that after I was dead, things would still be the same as they were now. Now, here I was standing in the middle of the office, trembling with fear, not wanting to face the white men outside. Maybe they were here to tell me something terrible had happened. Maybe they just came to make sure I was here. George was out in the country talking to some farmers, and Betty was cleaning the Freedom House. How I wished one of them were here now, so they could go outside instead of me. Finally, I stopped shaking long enough to make myself walk out of the office. "You can't be getting scared without finding out who they are and what they want," I kept telling myself. As I approached the car and took a good look at the 2 men inside, I was almost positive I didn't recognize them from Centerville. Feeling almost limp from relief, I walked up to the driver and said, "I was told you would like to see the person in charge." "Yes, we are from the FBI, he said, showing me his identification. "We are here to investigate the shooting. Where can we find the 5 kids who were involved?" I stood there mad as hell. "The stupid bastards," I thought. There I was getting all flustered and scared because of my mother's letter, not knowing who they were. Why didn't you come inside and present yourselves as officials from the FBI? I asked angrily. We just don't happen to run out into the streets to see every white man that drives up in front of this office, you know. After all, it might just be someone ready to blow our heads off. Can you tell me where I can find those five kids that got shot? He asked again, a little indignant. I'll see if I can find the addresses for you, I said sweetly. Why don't you two come inside for a minute? I knew they weren't particularly interested in getting out of their car and coming into the office. However, I gave them a look that said, you'll never get those addresses unless you do. So they followed me. They stood around impatiently, looking at our broken-down chairs and sofa, as if to say, what a shame. These niggers have to come into a place and open up a joint like this and cause all this trouble for us. I can find only three of the addresses for you, I said. I would like that you wait and see George Raymond, our project director. He should be back soon, and he'll be able to show you where they live. Why don't you two have a seat until he comes? What time do you expect him? One asked. Within 15 or 20 minutes, I said. Realizing they had to wait that long, they decided to sit. They placed themselves carefully on the sofa, as if it was diseased or something. They must be from the South, I thought. Where are you two from? I asked. New Orleans, one said. They waited restlessly until George returned. He spent a few hours driving around with them, and they saw all the kids and questioned them. That was the extent of their investigation. The same afternoon they left town, and we never saw or heard from them after that. By the beginning of August, when the teenage canvassers still had not returned, Dave Dennis decided to bring in three other workers, two girls, who were students from Jackson, and a boy called Flukey, a core task force worker. There were now six of us, but there was still more work than we could handle. George and Flukey went out in the country each day to talk with farmers and to scout for churches to conduct workshops in. The rest of us were left to canvass and look after the office. So far, we had only been able to send a handful of Negroes to the courthouse to attempt to register, and those few that went began to get fired from their jobs. This discouraged others who might have registered. Meanwhile, we were constantly being threatened by the whites. Almost every night, someone came running by to tell us the whites planned to bump us off. One evening, just before dark, someone took a shot at a pregnant Negro woman who was walking home with her two small sons. This happened in a section where a few poor white families lived. The woman stood in the street with her children, screaming and yelling for help. A Negro truck driver picked them up and drove them to the Boyd Street Housing Project, which was right across the street from the Freedom House. She was still yelling and screaming when she got out of the truck, and people ran out of all the project houses. The woman stood there telling everyone what happened. She was so big, it looked as though she was ready to have the baby any minute. As I looked at the other women standing around her, I didn't like what I saw in their faces. I could tell what they were thinking. Why don't you all get out of here before you get us all killed? After this incident, Negro participation dropped off to almost nothing, and things got so rough, we were afraid to walk the streets. In addition, our money was cut off. We were being paid $20 a week by the Voter Education Project, a southern agency which supported voter registration for Negroes. They said that since we were not producing registered voters, they could not continue to put money into the area. It seemed things were getting rough from every angle. We sometimes went for days without a meal. I was getting sick and losing lots of weight. When the NAACP invited me to speak at a Thursday night women's rally in Jackson, at one of the big churches, I tried to prepare a speech that would get across to them how we were suffering in Canton. Everything went wrong the night of the rally. 10 minutes before Dave arrived to pick me up, Jean, one of the new girls, had a terrible asthma attack, and we had to drop her off at the hospital in Jackson. I arrived at the church exhausted and an hour late, still wearing the skirt and blouse I had worked in all day. They looked like I had slept in them for weeks. The mistress of ceremonies was just explaining that I was unable to make it when I walked straight up on the stage. She turned and looked at me as if I was crazy and didn't say another word. She just took her seat, and I walked up to the mic. By this time, I had completely forgotten my prepared speech, and I don't remember exactly what I said at first. I had been standing up there, I don't know how long, when the mistress of ceremonies said, "You are running overtime." I got mad at her and thought I would tell the audience exactly what I was thinking. When I finished telling them about the trouble we were having in Canton, I found myself crying. Tears were running down my cheeks, and I was shaking and saying, "What are we going to do? Starve to death? Look at me. I've lost about 15 pounds in a week." I stood there going to pieces until Reverend Ed King walked up on the platform, put his arm around me, and led me away. Outside, he said, "You touched them, Anne. I think you got your message across." He was still standing with his arm around me, and I was drying my eyes when Dave came up. "What's wrong with her?" he asked. "She just finished a speech, which I think was tremendous," Reverend King said. "But I think she needs a rest, Dave." Dave took me to his apartment in Jackson and said I could rest there a couple of days. I didn't really think about what had happened during my speech until I was in bed trying to sleep. Then I realized I was cracking up, and I began to cry again. When I got back to Canton on Sunday, I discovered that a tub of food had been brought in from Jackson. We arrived just in time to find Fluky helping himself to some golden brown chicken. He gave me a note that had been left with the food. "Dear Anne, brought some food for your people. Your speech was something Thursday night. However, you need a rest. Why don't you come spend a week with me? See you next week. Let me know if the food runs out before then. You take care of yourself. Mrs. Young." I knew Mrs. Young through her sons, who had gone to jail with me during the demonstrations in Jackson. She had 9 children, 5 of whom had been arrested. She was a beautiful lady, and I appreciated the food she brought. But I felt bad about taking it, thinking about all those children she had and no husband. Dave and Maddie Dennis and Jerome Smith, another Corps field secretary, moved into Canton with us the next week. Dave felt that the only way we were going to get any money put back into the area was if we got more people registered. Suddenly, we began to get quite a lot of support from the local Negroes. Mr. Chin began working with us almost full-time. They saw that we were trying hard and that we were doing our best under the circumstances. Every day now, we managed to send a few Negroes to the courthouse. Soon, we had a steady flow moving daily, but the registrar was flunking them going and coming. Sometimes, out of 20 or 25 Negroes who went to register, only 1 or 2 would pass the test. Some of them were flunked because they used a title, Mr. or Mrs., on the application, blank. Others because they didn't. And most failed to interpret a section of the Mississippi Constitution to the satisfaction of Foot Campbell, the Madison County Circuit Clerk. All of the Negroes who flunked but should have passed the test were asked to fill out affidavits to be sent to the Justice Department. Hundreds of these were sent, and finally 2 men came down from Washington to look at the county registrar's books. They talked with the registrar and persuaded him to register 4 or 5 people who had flunked because of using Mr. or Mrs. One of them was a blind man who had failed several times, and who should not have had to take the test anyway. To keep up the pace, Dave brought in two more workers. Now there were nine of us working full-time. When this news got to the white community and they sensed the support we must be getting, they began to threaten us again. One Friday evening, just as we were finishing dinner, Sonny's brother Robert came running into the kitchen. He was sweating and panting as if he had been running for a long time. At first, he didn't say anything. We all sat and stared, waiting. He just stared back. He looked like he was trying to decide how to tell us something. I thought that he had been chased by someone. "Man, what's wrong with you?" George finally asked.
Robert began.
"Man, y'all better get out of Canton tonight. I got a funny feeling when I was walking around in town tonight, so I went over to that Black Tom's Cafe to see what people were talking about. Sure enough, one of them drunk bastards sitting up there saying they're gonna kill all them damn freedom workers tonight."
"What? Who said that?"
Jerome Smith yelled.
"You got more sense, Robert, than to go believe what you hear some drunkard saying in a cafe."
"Man, listen. Listen. You don't believe me? Go ask Jolie. He was sitting there a long time. He said he was just about to come over and tell y'all. They really gonna do it. They really gonna do it tonight. Did Dave go to Jackson yet? Man, y'all better get out of Canton."
"What do you mean, Robert?" I asked. "How did that guy find out?"
"Them whites probably spread that shit just so it'll get back to us. If they were really gonna kill us, wouldn't any nigga in town know anything about it till it was all over with?"
"Moody, that man work for Howard, who's behind all this shit here in Canton, and if he say he heard something, he heard it."
"That's what I just said. It was intended for him to hear," I said.
"George, y'all can sit here and listen to Annie Moody if you want to, but I swear to God, you better get out of here. You think that fucking nigga would have said anything if he hadn't have been drunk?"
It was hard for us to believe what Robert was saying. However, none of us had ever seen him this nervous before. Finally, George and Jerome decided that they would go into town to see if they could find out anything. By the time they got back, it was pitch black outside. As soon as Jerome burst in the door, we could all see that Robert had been right.
"Them white folks in town's together, man, and we better do something, but quick," he said, almost out of breath.
I knew we were in bad shape. Dave had taken the car into Jackson for the weekend, and the only people in town that would put us up were C.O. and Minnie Lou, and they weren't home. So we just sat there until after 11, trying to figure out a way to get out of Canton. We couldn't walk because there was only one way in and one way out, and we knew they could just as well mow us down on the highway.
"We are just wasting time sitting here bullshitting like this. I ain't about to go down that dark-ass road, and I ain't about to stay in this damn house either,"
Fluky said.
"Y'all can sit here and talk all night if you want to," Betty said,
suddenly appearing in the doorway with a blanket in her arms.
"But I'm gonna take my ass out back in that tall grass and worry about getting out of here tomorrow."
Since Sonny's house was new, he hadn't cultivated a garden yet, so the space behind the house where the garden would have been had grown wild with tall weeds. Sonny them just mowed the back lawn right up to the weeds and let them grow like hedges. It didn't take us long to agree that the weeds were our only way out. Even so, we knew that there was still a good chance that we would be discovered back there, but we had no other choice. So we pulled open the curtains and left the lamps on dim so that anyone could see that the house was empty. We also removed the sheets and blankets and left the spreads so the beds looked made. We waited until about 12:30 when all the lights in the neighborhood had been turned out. Then we sneaked out back with blankets and sheets clutched in our arms. The nine of us spaced ourselves so that from a distance no one patch of grass would look mashed down. The five guys made us girls stay behind them. We agreed not to do anything but look and listen without saying a word to each other. I was wrapped in one of the spreads, and after lying still for what seemed like hours, I began to get very cold and stiff. I couldn't hear a sound, not even a cricket, and I began to feel like I was all alone out there. I listened for Betty's breathing, but I heard nothing. I wondered if the others were feeling as alone and scared as I was. I could feel the grass getting wet with dew, and I began to get colder and colder. I kept thinking about what might happen to us if they found us out there. I tried hard not to think about it, but I couldn't help it. I could see them stomping us in the face and shooting us. I also kept thinking about the house and whether we had left some clue that we were out back. Suddenly, I heard a noise, and I could almost feel everyone jump with me.
"Don't get scared. It's that damn dog next door. Just be quiet and he'll shut up,"
one of the guys whispered. Now I knew we were in for it. That damn dog kept on whimpering. I could see the neighbor coming out and discovering us just when the clan drove up. But finally the dog was quiet again. I must have begun to doze off when I heard a car door slam.
"Quiet! Quiet! They're here!"
Fluky whispered as someone moved in the grass. I couldn't even breathe. My whole chest began to hurt as I heard the mumbling voices toward the front of the house. When the mumbling got louder, I knew that they were in the back, but I still couldn't make out what they were saying. As I heard them moving around in the backyard, I had a horrible feeling that they could see us as plain as daylight, and I just trembled all over. But in a few minutes, I heard the car door slam again, and they were gone. We lay quietly in case they had pulled a trick. Finally, Jerome whispered loudly,
"They think we're at CO's. They'll probably be back."
Soon the roosters were crowing, and it began to get light. Sure enough, they drove up again, but this time they must have just taken a quick look, because they were gone almost immediately. We knew they wouldn't be back because it was too light, so we sneaked back in the house before the neighbors got up. George, who had been in a position to see and hear them, told us what happened. He said that there was a pickup truck with about 8 men who had obviously been drinking. They had all sorts of weapons. They discussed burning the house down, but decided that they would come back and get us another night. After this incident, Robert and a group of men all in their middle or late 20s formed a group to protect us. 3 or 4 of them had already lost their jobs because they tried to register. They couldn't find other jobs, so they followed us around everywhere we went, walking with us as if they were bulletproof. They also spread rumors that the Freedom House was protected by armed men. We were all still a little uptight and afraid to sleep at night, but after a while, when the whites didn't come back, we figured the rumors worked. The threats didn't bother me as much now. I began to feel almost safe with those men around all the time. Their interests, courage, and concern gave all of us that extra lift we needed. Now every Negro church in the county was open for workshops. The 9 of us split into groups of 3. Almost every night we had workshops in different churches, sometimes 16 to 30 miles out of town. 1 or 2 of our protective guys had cars. They were usually sent along with the girls out in the country. It was dark and dangerous driving down those long country rock roads, but now that we always had 2 or 3 of the guys riding with us, it wasn't so bad. In fact, once we got to the churches, everything was fine. Listening to those old Negroes sing freedom songs was like listening to music from heaven. They sang them as though they were singing away the chains of slavery. Sometimes I just looked at the expressions on their faces as they sang, and cold chills would run down my back. Whenever God was mentioned in a song, I could tell by the way they said the word that most of them had given up here on earth. They seemed to be waiting just for God to call them home and end all the suffering. The nightly church workshops were beginning to be the big thing going for us at this point in the campaign. However, the white folks found out about this and tried to put a stop to it. One night, out in the country, three carloads of whites chased George and a group of the guys all the way to Canton. George said they were shooting at them like crazy. Since George thought the whites could have killed them if they had wanted to, we took it as a warning. We were extra careful after that. The luckiest thing that happened to us was that we had succeeded in getting C.O. Chin to work with us. He was a powerful man, known as Badass C.O. Chin, to the Negroes and whites alike. All of the Negroes respected him for standing up and being a man. Most of the whites feared him. He was the type of person that didn't take shit from anyone. If he was with you, he was all for you. If he didn't like you, that was it. In that case, he just didn't have anything to do with you. Because he was respected by most of the local Negroes, he was our most effective speaker in the churches. He was in a position to speak his mind, and what he said was taken without offense to anyone in particular. Just as Mr. Chin opened up full force, the whites cut in on him. Within a week, he was forced to close his place, and he began moving out most of his things. This still wasn't enough to satisfy the whites. One evening, when he was taking home the 45 he had kept around for protection, he was stopped and arrested by those damn cops that hung around the office all the time. He was immediately taken to jail and charged with carrying a concealed weapon. Actually, he had placed the gun on the seat beside him. His bail was set at $500. He was in jail for a week before his family could find anyone to post a property bond. Most of the local Negroes had borrowed money on their property, which meant that it couldn't be used for bail purposes. I think this was the beginning of C.O.'s realization of what had happened to him. Not only had he lost everything he had, he was sitting in jail with no one to go to his bail. Instead of this putting the damper on his activities as the whites had expected, it increased them. He began hitting harder than ever. Often when he was speaking, he would say, "Take me, for example. They have completely put me out of business. I have lost practically everything I have. These young workers are here starving to death trying to help you people. And for what? A lot of you ain't worth it." Not one of us working for CORE could have talked to the local people like that. It was the middle of August now, and we had been working in the county for 2 months. Up until this time, not one of the ministers in Canton had committed himself to helping us. When they did give us a chance to speak in their churches, it was only for 2 or 3 minutes during the announcements. The biggest Negro church in Canton was pastored by Canton's biggest Tom. Most of his congregation were middle-class bourgeois Negroes. We all knew that if we could somehow force him to move, every other large church in Canton would open its doors to us. We set up a meeting and invited all the ministers, but since the number one minister didn't show up, all the others did was mumble to each other and tell us, "We can't do anything until Reverend Tucker says so." After that, we decided to forget the ministers and go to work on their congregations. At this point, the ministers started coming around. In fact, they called a meeting to talk things over with us. But the talk was fruitless. The ministers tried to play the same game the southern white people played when things got too hot for them. That is, to find out what you are thinking and try and get you to hold off long enough for them to come up with some new strategy to use on you. Those Toms weren't as dumb as they appeared, I thought. They had learned to play Mr. Charlie's game pretty well. We had a surprise for them, though. They had made headway with several of their most influential members, and they put us right where we wanted to go, behind the pulpits for more than 5 minutes. Now we could hit the Canton churches hard. For a little while, that good old movement spirit was on the surge again. Everyone began to feel it. We still were not getting any money, but for the most part, we didn't need any. The Canton Negroes began to take good care of us, and we were never hungry. A Negro service station owner even let us have gas on credit. What pleased me most was that many of our teenagers had come back. I had really missed them. Chapter 24. Toward the end of August, it suddenly seemed as if everyone in our group was leaving. The Jackson High School students went back to school. One girl left for New York to get married, and one guy went to California. Soon, George and I were the only ones left. To make things worse, the high schools in the Canton area were opening in a week. Dave promised to bring in a couple of more people, but meanwhile it seemed as though George and I would have to do all the work ourselves. We also had to find a new place to stay, since Sonny and his wife went back together. This was a problem because people just didn't want to risk letting us live with them. Within a week, however, we found a place which was ideal, a two-apartment house, one apartment for the girls and one for the boys. Great, I thought, just when everyone's leaving. I was so busy moving into the new place that I completely forgot that the August 28th March on Washington was only a few days off. I had been planning to go ever since it was announced. Suddenly, it was August 26th, and I didn't even have a ride lined up. There had been no room for me and other staff people on the bus, since there were so many local Negroes who wanted to make the trip. Reverend King and his wife were driving up and offered to take me, though they warned me it would be quite risky driving through most of the southern states in an integrated car. I told them I was willing to take the chance if they were. On August 27th at 6 a.m., we headed for Washington. There were five of us, three whites, Reverend King, his wife, and Joan Trumpower, and two Negroes, Bob, a student returning to Harvard, and myself. In the beginning, we were all a little uneasy, but somehow we made it through the southern states without incident. After driving all day and night, we arrived at the grounds of the Washington Monument just in time for the march and joined the section of Southern delegates. Up on a podium near our section, various celebrities, Mahalia Jackson, Odetta, Peter, Paul, and Mary were singing. During a break in the entertainment, the Mississippi delegates were asked to come to the podium and sing freedom songs. I got up and followed the others to the platform reluctantly. I think I was the only girl from Mississippi with a dress on. All the others were wearing denim skirts and jeans. We sang a couple of songs, and shortly after, it was announced that the march to the Lincoln Memorial was about to start. Thousands of people just took off, leaving most of their leaders on the podium. It was kind of funny to watch the leaders run to overtake the march. The way some of them had been leading the people in the past, perhaps the people were better off leading themselves, I thought. The march was now in full motion, and there were people everywhere. Some were on crutches, some in wheelchairs, and some were actually being carried down Pennsylvania and Constitution Avenues. There were all kinds of signs and placards. One group of men acting as pallbearers carried a casket that said, "Bury Jim Crow." By the time we got to Lincoln Memorial, there were already thousands of people there. I sat on the grass and listened to the speakers to discover we had dreamers instead of leaders leading us. Just about every one of them stood up there dreaming. Martin Luther King went on and on talking about his dream. I sat there thinking that in Canton, we never had time to sleep, much less dream. I left Washington 2 days later with Joan Trumpower and the Kings. As we drove out of town, no one had very much to say. I guess they were thinking about the historic event that had just taken place. I was thinking about it, too, and I was also thinking that this was the first time in well over a year I had been away from my work with the movement and away from Mississippi. I had really forgotten what it was like to be out of an atmosphere of fear and threats. I had even gone to a movie. The last movie I had seen
had been in New Orleans the previous summer. "It's kind of strange," I thought. "I never really think of going to a movie when I'm in Mississippi. There was always so much work, so many problems, and so many threats that I hardly ever thought of anything except how to best get the job done and survive from day to day. I noticed that Washington seemed like a deserted town compared to 2 days ago. How had 250,000 people disappeared so quickly? I seriously began to wonder whether those 250,000 people had made any impact on Congress. As we began to drive through Virginia, I started to worry about the trip back. I was now the only Negro in the car. The white people of the South must really have some strong feelings about the march by now, I thought. I knew when we returned to Mississippi, we would be faced with twice as many threats and acts of violence. And maybe we'd never even get back to Mississippi. After all, we had to go back through the rest of those backward-ass states. We were going to go through Alabama, and I knew damn well how bad that state was. Reverend King must have thought of the dangers of the trip back, too. When we stopped at a Howard Johnson restaurant right inside the Tennessee border, he suggested that we spend the night in Tennessee, then get up and drive through Alabama during the day. When I discovered where we were going to sleep,